Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, the editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you guys today?
Great.
I'm doing great.
Before we get started on this week's show, I just wanted to tell everybody a bit about RebellerMedia.com. RebellerMedia.com is your one-stop shop for all your film writing needs. Every day on my crack team of editors, we will be gathering the most interesting movie news and essays on the web for you to browse through. Think of us a bit like the Drudge Report, but for Hollywood. After you are done checking out the day's headlines, we hope you'll stick around and enjoy some Rebeller originals. We had some great pieces last week, one by Sheila O'Malley on costumes and Walter Hill movies. That was one of my favorite things that we've published on the site yet, though any week in which you get Michael Biehn to stop by and talk about Stanley Kubrick's treatment of actors will be hard to top. So I'm very excited for the stuff we have on the site. I hope you people are all enjoying it. I'm having a great time editing and commissioning these pieces. We are paying these people good money for the content you are enjoying, including the content you're enjoying right now. So we hope you will sign up for a membership, which will give you unlimited access to everything on the site. It's just $2 a month or $20 for the whole year. That is less than most Patreons, and we think you're getting a lot more bang for your buck. So, you know, sign up, enjoy. We hope to have you around. And now on to the show. First up is controversies and nontroversies. Warner Brothers has decided to give up on humans altogether, granting greenlight power to Skynet. Okay, technically, the movie company is called Synalytic, and technically, it's not giving the algo the power to start shooting movies, but Warner's is using the film to make business decisions based on who can open what sort of movie in what kind of territory. Taking the human element out of even these decisions, reducing suitability to predictive box office dollars and cents, feels like a pretty big misstep, however. As Zach Stentz noted in a viral tweet, quote, "The entire Marvel Cinematic Universe was built on Favreau convincing a bunch of executives that a middle-aged actor not long out of rehab in prison, who had described himself as box office poison even during his earlier 1990s heyday, would be the perfect Iron Man," end quote. So, Peter, I guess my question for you is a very simple one. Would the algorithm greenlight me, Sonny Bunch, as the lead of an old Spider-Man movie? You know, like old Logan, but old Spider-Man? Because that's literally all I've ever wanted. And if it will do that, I'm fine with this.
There's a great old Spider-Man sequence in Jason Aaron's Deathlock comic from maybe 10 years ago, in which he runs into a grizzled old bearded Spider-Man who looks weirdly like Sonny Bunch. He's been through a lot of stuff because the apocalypse has happened and etc. So I think the answer is probably, if it had Google Analytics, like access to Google image search, and could see what you look like, yeah, definitely we would have the Sonny Bunch old Spider-Man movie. No, of course not. Of course it wouldn't, because what machines, what like algorithm driven filmmaking does is tell you what has already worked and then say, let's do more of that. And since you have never played Spider-Man and never been Spider-Man, and in fact no old Spider-Man movie has ever worked, I think we would end up in a situation where the machines would definitely say, no, Sonny.
I'm sorry, but you're forgetting the success of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. So you would probably not be greenlit as old Spider-Man in a leading role, but you might get to be the voice of middle-aged, depressed Spider-Man in an animated movie.
I could live with that.
Like
I could live with that.
Punchy Spider-Man, the one with the gut. Like, he's the one I related to, by the way.
You would become the only actor who has to, like, revert your diet to become Punchy Spider-Man. It would be amazing. The algorithm is going to let you star as Spider-Man and eat whatever you want. Yay, algorithm!
That's a more positive response than I expected, Alyssa, frankly. I do think this is a... this is a relatively interesting and serious and kind of terrible development, don't you guys think? It's not Netflix level terrible where they're kind of saying, this is the action beat you have to hit at this minute, this is the reveal you have to hit at this minute, which is a thing that they do and they kind of program into their films and they tell their filmmakers to look out for. But it is its own kind of weird and terrible and outsourcing you know, the imagination to the computer. Don't you guys think? I struggle to imagine a world in which the like Robert Evanses of the world could succeed with a computer breathing down their neck like this.
Well, it also seems exceptionally weird to do this precisely at a moment when, you know, it's unclear how the next phase of the Marvel Cinematic Universe is going to unfold, when the Star Wars movies, while profitable, have sort of not quite resonated with people in the way that you might have expected. And so precisely at the moment when it seems like the entertainment industry might need to start looking for some more of those new and unprecedented ideas to give power to an algorithm that by design can only look at what's been successful in the past, feels more risky than it might even have done a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a real danger in this kind of approach to development, in that you just get a lot of movies that feel really the same. So I saw 1917 at a movie theater this week, and it was shocking how many of the trailers that I saw in advance featured CGI animals. It was just CGI animals all the way down the line. As far as I can tell, we are getting nothing but CGI animal movies for the next 6 months.
This will be a CGI animal podcast.
Right, and like that's what we're going to have to talk about is CGI animal technology. And that has happened, that is happening even before this sort of technology is being employed. And so this is the other thing that I do want to bring into this, is that yes, this is a new front in the Hollywood sameness kind of a wars, right? The attempts to just to calculate what is going to do well in advance and to try and prove that William Goldman was wrong when he said nobody knows anything. To make a system in which you can determine in advance exactly what's going to be profitable. At the same time, studio execs have been doing this for decades, and studio execs are, in many cases, not in the business of trying to produce great, original, lasting movies. They are trying to make $150 million on a $50 million production budget. That's what they want to do, and they will do that. If CGI animals will do that all year long, then they're going to commission all CGI animal movies.
So what you're saying, Peter, is that capitalism has failed us.
What I'm saying is that the incentives of the movie industry end up delivering a certain kind of product. At the same time, what have we been talking about for the last several weeks, for the last several months, is how Netflix actually has so much money and has to spend so fast. Netflix, which has pioneered kind of new territory, new ground in terms of using data in order to make their production decisions, Netflix has been spending money on prestige films that can't get made anywhere else because they're too uncommercial. And so what I'm saying is capitalism is providing great movies for us, folks.
As always, capitalism provides.
Well, it is interesting, though, just because if you look at what Netflix has been doing with the algorithm, it's actually sort of given a little bit of life to some genres that the traditional studio system has kind of given up for dead. You know, you've gotten some really winning romantic comedies on Netflix, and that is a genre that is sort of withered in the mainstream studio system because there is not the sense that you can make $500 million doing it. On the other hand, you can shoot the movie for $20 million, and if that, and make $80 million or $100 million if something is really a hit. And so I don't think that this is a good way to make decisions. It kind of seems like a CYA move. It's like, well, the algorithm made me do it. But I would be interesting. I would be interested to see if the algorithm suggests some weird stuff. And so because I'm a little bit of a dystopian, like, I think it's going to be horrible, but also I'm maybe a little bit into it.
You know, I also think that this sort of data is just going to be, it's going to end up being used in a way that's just kind of advisory. And if you look at interviews with Netflix development executives in particular, you know, what people said about them early on, all the reports were these guys just greenlight the things that their data they have says they should greenlight, and they have this huge trove of viewer data that will tell them exactly what to do. And the further they've gotten into just blasting out huge amounts of content, the more their execs are like, yes, we use the data to tell us a little bit and to help guide us, but actually we're using much, it's now much more about gut and instinct and what's available. And so they have actually moved away from using data as the primary driver. And now they're, you know, I may be slightly getting these numbers wrong, but one of their execs said something within the last year that was like, well, when we started, it was 80% data and 20% gut, and now it's 20% data and 80% gut. And that tells you a lot about how these tools end up getting used over time.
Yeah, you know, that is actually a very interesting point. I mean, it does kind of drive home the fact that movie making, even in the age of computers and algorithms and trying to appeal to China and America and Russia and Brazil and the United Kingdom and Korea all at the same time, you know, you still kind of have
to. Don't forget the Saudis, yeah.
Yeah, you kind of have to just say, like, okay, this is a thing that works and this is a thing that doesn't work, and we're gonna try to make the things that work but also the things that we like.
Comedies with CGI animals.
Romances between CGI animals. We're finally going to get that, like, full-on sexy Lion King
sequel. The R-rated Lady and the Tramp.
Yeah, this is way more dystopian than even I imagine this conversation would go. It's the worst thing I've ever heard. All right, so guys, what do you think?
Canceled.
What do you guys think? Is Warner Brothers hiring a data analytics firm to use Skynet to tell us what is good and what is bad? A controversy or a non-troversy?
Remains to be seen.
I think it's a non-troversy. Studios have always attempted to use whatever kind of data they can, whatever kind of feedback they can get from audiences, whatever kind of numerical analysis they can put together to make their decisions. This is just more of the same.
Peter is wrong. It is a controversy. This is the worst thing that has ever happened to movies since the last terrible thing that happened to movies. All right. Now we turn to our main feature, which is 1917. For the record, I just want to throw this out there because we've had a few complaints. Consider this your spoiler warning. There's a reason we do this show on Mondays after the movie has come out. It's so we can discuss it in full, and we hope you have seen it as well before you listen. But, you know, if you haven't, this is the spoiler warning. You can skip ahead if you would like. Sam Mendes' World War I movie has a gimmick. It was cast entirely by an AI. It was designed to look as if the whole thing takes place in one continuous shot, or really kind of a pair of continuous shots. There's a conspicuous break in the middle. That is right. As a pair of lance corporals trudge through no man's land on the World War I battlefield, that space between the British trenches and the German trenches, the camera, operated by the great Roger Deakins, stays on our heroes throughout. It's an interesting trick and immersive, and one that, for me, doesn't entirely work. Ironically, it kind of pulled me out of the movie rather than immersing me into it, because I spent the whole time looking for the seams, those little spaces where the edits were hidden. Luckily, the movie has more than that going for it. It has some pretty compelling performances. It has some legitimately tense action sequences. And it has the aforementioned Deakins, who lights this thing like his life depended on it. I'm sure we're going to talk about a couple of those sequences in a few minutes. But first, Alyssa, did you feel immersed in the movie or distracted by the technique on display here?
So I should be clear that I watched this movie the way God intended it on my laptop during an incredibly busy workday. So I think I was less distracted by sort of the seams in the technique because I was sitting in the middle of the Washington Post offices. But I should note that for me, it ended up being much more a movie about the performances than it was about specifically that technique. I do think it's a beautifully lit, beautifully shot movie, but I just found myself not really thinking about that as time went on. It just became less important to me.
Peter, you're a Deakins guy. What's your take here on the technique on display and kind of his work in general here?
I'm a huge Roger Deakins fan, and in some ways, I want to give Roger Deakins credit for making this movie. Yes, it's a Sam Mendes film, and you can see that Mendes is interested in long stitched together takes. We talk about this with Spectre, even in the absence of Roger Deakins. But Roger Deakins is the cameraman that is sort of, you know, a shot designer who makes Mendes' work really pop. And you can see that in a couple of sequences in here. The one that stood out the most was this nighttime action scene in a maze-like, bombed-out village where there's explosions in the sky creating this sort of strobe effect, you know, kind of mysterious figures off in the distance who you have to run from and in some cases get attacked by. And it's just an incredible series of images. And what you really see in this film is that Roger Deakins, almost independent of what's going on, is just... He's Hollywood's greatest image maker. I will also say that, as with Alyssa, I watched this in a not ideal format, which is that I went to a movie theater to see this, and the projection was just fouled up. And the light was all wrong. There was something wrong, I think, with the bulb, and the top 20% of the screen had a weird shadow over it, and the colors looked all wrong. I've watched trailers online just to confirm that I'm not crazy about this. But I saw this at a movie theater in Washington, D.C., and I was really, really frustrated the entire time because it looked
name and shame.
Awful.
Name it.
This
name
was
and
the
shame, Peter.
Regal Gallery Place on 7th Street in Washington, D.C., and they had the movie here before anybody. And they were like, it was like an exclusive booking for a couple of weeks, and it just looked awful.
And I will say, you know, despite watching it under these imperfect conditions, one of the reasons it's really enjoyable, if you like Deakins, is because to a certain extent, it's showing off just how many things he can do and just how many things he can make look incredibly good. You have these incredibly painterly shots of parts of the countryside that have not been blown entirely to hell. You have the nighttime sequences. And then this is a movie that just makes clear how physically dirty and disgusting war is. The sort of granular level of detail in shell craters, the remains of barbed wire, just the mud and muck and putrefaction all over the battlefield. And he does all of these things incredibly well. It's not a showy movie, but I mean, maybe a little bit of a showy movie. It's okay, fine. It's a showy movie.
It's kind of an incredibly showy technical gimmick, right?
This is almost the definition of a showy movie. I mean, if you design a movie to take place, to look as if it is all one shot, it's actually almost harder than making it actually one shot.
Right,
because then you
course.
Have to like build edits into it, and you have to build camera moves that will obscure various things. So I think it's definitely
fine,
a showy movie.
But it's, I mean... the reason that I suggested it was not showy is because to a certain extent, a lot of it's just ordinary, right? I mean, it's not, there are some things that are sort of for the spectacle, but, you know, this is, for a lot of the time, it's sort of a soldier's eye view of the combat. And it does this really, you know, you see the contrast between this incredible beauty and this filth. And there are times, like when they come into the village with the trees in bloom, where the beauty feels so wrong. I mean, it's really the range of things that they do within what's supposed to be by design this very narrow perspective. It's very impressive.
Yeah, it's very intimate. It's not an epic in the kind of Saving Private Ryan sense. You know, I liked this movie a lot. I respect what it's doing quite a bit. I really appreciated its... not all that subtle anti-war message in the way that it sort of like the hero was trying to stop an attack, not win a battle, but keep people from dying by walking into a trap. And so it does all these kind of interesting anti-war things. But I think, you know, I'm curious, Sonny, you said you didn't think it totally worked just because it took you out of it. I also found, I guess it's Sam Mendes. Does this thing, I can't even quite describe it. His movies all have this ultra serious tone that is sort of the definition of like what a serious movie is supposed to be. It's like he's making, it's almost like verging on parody, you know, in a way that it's like, this is a best picture contender. This is a serious movie about war and death. And like, there's something that's just a little bit too much about it. There's something just, it's like not, I want a little bit of humor. Or I want a little bit of, just a little more kind of light engagement with something. Yes, I know that's maybe not the right thing to ask for in a movie like this. But there's just a little bit of a self-seriousness to all of Sam Mendes' work, right? And you go back to like American Beauty and the stupid paper bag floating in the wind or whatever it was. And there's always this like sense of, oh, yes, there is deep meaning here that I I don't always react entirely well to.
It's interesting. I had sort of, when I was seeing the trailers for this, I want to sort of turn the subject a little bit. I thought I recognized one of the lead actors, and it turns out that it's George MacKay, who starred a couple years ago in this movie called Pride, about a real historical incident where a group of LGBT people in a British mining community during the miners' strike decided to support the local miners, even though the miners weren't necessarily sure that they wanted the help. I really like him as an actor. He plays Lance Corporal Schofield, and he's the one who makes it to the end of the movie. And I just really like him as an actor, in part because he has this like really interesting watchful quality. He's quiet, right? I mean, part of the structure of the movie here is that he doesn't want to talk about the medal he got rid of. He doesn't want to talk about his family or what's waiting for him at home. And at the end of the movie, you finally see him kind of acknowledge this yearning and the family who misses him to himself. And to me, that was what gave his performance is really what gives the movie. It's a very human quality. And the scene where he is running across the line of advancing soldiers and getting knocked down, and he's so exhausted. I mean, he's just at the point of not being able to do it anymore and keeps going. I thought it was such wonderful work. And I don't know, he sort of single-handedly gave the movie that quality for me, that ability to connect.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I do think the lead performances here should get more credit than I think they have been getting. I don't think there's been a lot of talk about Oscar buzz for these guys. Now, granted, the acting categories are kind of stacked this year, and this is a director Lee movie, a director Lee and cinematographer kind of heavy movie. But they are quite good. Peter, can I ask as the gamer of the room, as the gamer in the room, did the movie ever strike you as very reminiscent of a video game?
Absolutely. I thought about that quite a bit while watching it. I mean, really, when you get into those trench sequences, and then the there's a big sequence maybe about 45 minutes into the movie where the two main characters, the two soldiers who've been sent on this mission, end up going through a kind of a dugout base that the Germans have left. And the camera is just following them almost exactly the same sort of shot that you see in third-person video games. And so because the camera doesn't cut, and because it is following our characters who are framed in the center of the frame from just a little bit overhead, with occasional kind of pans away to scenes that we need to, like, important things that we need to see, say, if a plane is flying overhead, it's really reminiscent of watching a video game. And this movie almost felt like watching a Twitch stream or something at times, except prettier and less awkward.
I will say the thing that was more distracting for me than I think sort of the cinematography for you, Sunny, or the video game elements for Peter was what I like to think of it as the prominent British actor problem.
Yes.
And it's a shame because, like, I love Colin Firth. I love Benedict Cumberbatch. I like Andrew Scott a lot. But
Mark Strong?
Mark Strong.
He's in this movie? like he's in every movie?
For 3 seconds. And, I mean, as someone who recapped Game of Thrones obsessively for basically a decade, it's really funny to me that Tommen Baratheon and Robb Stark are playing brothers in this movie. And so, but the extent to which all of these great British actors, by virtue of their ubiquity, and their ubiquity is because of their talent, have become incredibly distracting to see in movies, is a real conundrum, because I want to be happy to see them, but actually I'm very frustrated because I keep thinking, aha, like, you know, Mr. Darcy has finally showed up, you know, Sherlock Holmes is in the trench.
So I want to almost defend this, or at least ask you about what I think the strategy is here, which is that directors choose big name, notable actors to play these small parts to mark off sequences, to make them memorable. So we can talk about the Mark Strong sequence, and it's 10 minutes of the movie in which it's basically, he gets picked up from the village after an important thing has happened, and ends up in a truck convoy with a couple of other soldiers, and just gets to relate to some other people and sort of process an important event that has happened to him a little bit, right? And so Mark Strong creates a chapter-like structure for that sequence, just as Benedict Cumberbatch at the very end creates he is the final, in some ways the final boss who you get to, and he creates a chapter-like structure around the finale there, in which he's the resolution. You made it to the end and get to see Sherlock Holmes.
Although I will say,
well, but this is
no, go ahead.
I was just going to say this is also very video game like. This is
right.
One of the reasons
Benedict
why
Cumberbatch is the final boss.
Exactly. On top of that, though, just like having a recognizable face pop up out of nowhere after you've been following a bunch of guys walking with a camera behind them, kind of over their shoulder. Like every time I saw somebody I recognized from, the real world, I was like, oh, okay, this is the exposition scene. This is the cutscene. This is where they're going to tell us what the next goal is, what the next step in our fetch quest is. Which, again, this is, it's not even really a complaint, because I compare this movie slightly unfavorably to Midway in the review I wrote for RebellerMedia.com. I compared Midway unfavorably to this, in that Midway looks like a video game, right? It has the big CGI action spectacular, blah, blah, blah. It just looks very, very fake and cartoony in certain respects. But this movie is actually structured like a video game, and I think it more or less works for the reasons, Peter, that you say, that it kind of creates breaks in what is essentially supposed to be an unbroken film, and it gives people a chance to reset and process and
I think that was intentional
sort of discussion.
Because we know that Mendes and his casting director can create anonymous faces that you don't recognize and are willing to use actors who don't jump out as, oh, hey, it's that guy. And then at times they choose not to. And I think that's an intentional choice to demarcate these different sequences and give you something to latch on to in a way that separates the different sequences in the film.
Well, and I would say, to sort of button up the video game metaphor, yes, it has that structure, but none of the bosses actually stand in Schofield's way, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you get them, they show up, and instead of being people to battle, they help. Although one of the things that you end up seeing over and over again is, like, even in a situation where everyone wants to do everything right and where people are basically kind and decent and follow the chain of command and are willing to accept information that makes them look bad if it's the right thing to do, this is just an impossible situation. And, in contrast to the relative unshowiness of McKay's acting, the sort of climax of the section with Mark Strong, where they're trying to get the truck moving again, and his desperation is in total contrast to these guys who are sort of glad for the rest and don't actually want to help him move the truck. It's just, sometimes everyone can want to save everyone else and to take care of everyone else, and the truck just gets stuck in the mud and it's really hard to move. It's actually a movie without a lot of human indecency other than the war itself, but you are hammered over and over again about just how difficult and overwhelming the war is.
Okay, guys. So, what do you think here? Are we thumbs up or thumbs down on 1917?
Thumbs up.
Thumbs up.
Thumbs up. That's three thumbs up. All right. That brings us to assigned viewing. Assigned viewing this week is the camp classic Valley of the Dolls. Peter, why are we watching this movie that inspired you to immediately text Alyssa and I after you had watched it, announcing that you had many, many thoughts about it?
We are watching Valley of the Dolls, a 1967 film about three women trying to make it in Hollywood, because next week we're going to talk about Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So that's not only another movie about mid-century Hollywood culture and washed-up stars and the struggles of Hollywood, of people trying to make it in the Hollywood business, it is also a movie about Sharon Tate, the actress who was horrifically murdered by the Manson family gang in real life. And but before that, she starred as one of the actresses in Valley of the Dolls. This movie has a reputation as a camp classic, as a kind of awful, soap operatic, goofy, you know, just like a weirdly melodramatic film that doesn't really have anything to do with real human emotions or feelings. And in one way, I can see that. And yet when I watched it from the perspective, the kind of distance of time, you know, it's been 50 years or whatever, I really found it quite moving at times. And
oh my God.
And like strangely affecting in its portrayal of the toll that Hollywood takes on performers of all kinds, but especially on women and the ways that it treats people. And there's just moments that I thought were really interesting, like almost bits of time travel. We open with this New York sequence, and then you move over eventually to Los Angeles and seeing what New York looked like in the 1960s, seeing what Los Angeles looked like, kind of what the perceptions of these films were. I had just come back from New York, from a quick trip to New York on the day that I watched this, and so it was like, oh, this is what New York used to look like, and you know, having seen it just that morning. And so, yeah, I watched this, and I was really kind of surprised by how moved I was by it, and how emotionally relevant it felt. In fact, the one thing I'll say, and then I'll turn this over to you guys, is that this, we're watching this to set up Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But in some ways, it actually felt like a setup for Marriage Story, another movie about the way that Hollywood mistreats female performers, that is framed by a move from New York to Los Angeles and the distinctions between the performance culture, between, you know, a theatrical performance and Hollywood there. And so in a lot of ways, it seemed to me like a setup for both movies. And in fact, we're going to end up talking about Marriage Story in a couple of weeks here.
Alyssa, please tell me you have a more reasonable take on this movie.
So, I had never watched Valley of the Dolls before this, and part of the reason I wanted to is because Nora Ephron wrote sort of this great takedown of Jacqueline Suzanne, who wrote the novel that became Valley of the Dolls, in the New York Times Book Review in, God, what was it, 1969. And she described it as, Valley has a message that has a magnetic appeal for women readers. It described the standard female fantasy of going to the big city, striking it rich, meeting fabulous men, and went on to show every reader that she was far better off than the heroines in the book, who took pills, killed themselves, and made general messes of their lives. It was essentially a morality tale. And despite its reputation, it was not really a dirty book. Most women, I think, do not want to read hardcore pornography. They do not even want to read anything terribly technical about the sex act. What they want to read about is lust, and Jacqueline Suzanne gives it to them, just as Grace Metalius did. Hot lust, quivering lust, high school lust. Sweaters are always being ripped open in Miss Suzanne's books. Suzanne's pants are always being frantically unzipped, and everyone is always wanting everyone else. And I have to say, I do think Valley of the Dolls is a better movie than that, in part because... and I think that it is only possible to see it as a better movie than that description would suggest because of what we understand about how Hollywood works and has worked for a lot of women today. I mean, there's something kind of perfect about watching this as Harvey Weinstein is going on trial for rape and has been charged in a separate case in Los Angeles. But I think that part of the reason the movie works for me to the extent that it does is that all three of the lead actresses just really, you know, Barbara Perkins, Patty Duke, and Sharon Tate just really nail this deep melancholy that all of their characters have. And, like, this is, to be fair, in some ways a completely ridiculous movie. Like, the denouement from one of the characters involves her, like, flushing someone else's wig down the toilet. But it is this really sad movie about how these three women, one of them genuinely really talented, one of them not at all, or two of them, one of them, these three women, one of them genuinely talented, one of them smart but valued really only for her looks, and one who is valued not at all, I mean, other than for the fact that, like, she has bigger boobs than French women do. Like, literally, that is the epitome of her value in the movie. And they don't really survive those assessments of them. The only one who kind of survives is the smart one, who ultimately ends up going home and staying single and kicking a drug addiction, but retreating not just from her looks, but also from the smartness that made her an asset and could have made her a career if she was allowed to do something in business instead of just being pretty. I gather you hated this movie.
Yeah, I do not care for this movie very much. It's funny, I actually purchased it from the Criterion Collection after Once Upon a Time in Hollywood came out, because I was like, I want to see more Sharon Tate. I've been inspired by Quentin Tarantino to like really absorb more of her work as an actress. And she's fine in this. She's fine. I don't want to say anything other than that. But my real takeaway was this is just a bad movie. It's a bad movie, and it's not. I don't know. I guess maybe my problem is just with the kind of appreciation of camp or a specific kind of camp in general. But I have this hesitance against, you know, turning something that is earnestly kind of terrible into an object of adoration amongst a certain cult community. Maybe it's just because I'm not part of the community. I don't know. But I remember watching this thing and thinking, like, okay, sometimes movies are bad, but they're ridiculous, and that's why they kind of catch on. Like Zardoz, for instance, the movie where Sean Connery wears a red leather mankini, or I don't know how exactly you would describe that thing that he has on.
It's a
and,
diaper.
Like, does battle with a floating concrete head? You know, I like there's like a movie like that works on. Can work on several different levels, but it reaches heights of absurdity that that make those levels more interesting for me. This just felt
so
bad.
More floating rock heads.
Yeah, if this movie,
Sean Connery thighs,
would have made
this movie
had,
better for you.
What you're wanting, per Jacqueline Suzanne, is Sean Connery's thighs. That's where we've come down in this podcast.
Yeah, I mean something like that. I don't know if that's exactly how I would put it, but it just like I watched this movie and all I could think was, well, this is just bad. It's just like genuinely bad. It's not like ironically bad. It's not like humorously bad. It's just kind of bad. And I watched a bunch of the special features to try and figure out, you know, exactly like, okay, what is it that I'm missing here? What is it that people are seeing in this that I'm not? And I failed to figure it out. So I will be honest. I watched this movie. Now this is purely a discussion of the movie. The reason we are watching it, of course, is because of Sharon Tate, and the fact that she is in this movie and it is kind of one of her defining roles. And you know, as far as that goes, I thought again, I thought she was fine in this movie, and I find myself kind of preferring the idealized notion of Sharon Tate in my head that Quentin Tarantino has come up with. Maybe we just watched the wrong movie. Maybe we should have watched the movie that she watches in that movie theater and enjoys so heartily the reactions to. I don't know. Maybe this is as with many things, I'm sure this is a Sunny problem, not necessarily a other people problem.
I thought Sharon Tate in this movie was beautifully sad, and in a lot of ways, it helped me understand Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, because what Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is about is her lost potential. And the movie is the happy ending to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, spoilers, is that in that world, she survives to show us what she can really do. The point is that Tarantino is making is that we don't know what she could have done. There was so much more to her life, that she had so much to offer us, and we'll never know what that was. And through the magic of the movies, he can create a kind of separate fictional, you know, an imaginary timeline of a better world in which a drunk has-been, actor and his stunt double save Sharon Tate for the world. And, you know, we'll talk more about this when we actually get to talking about Hollywood, but it's a movie about Sharon Tate's, about the fact that we hardly got to know her, and that there was something that we lost, important when we lost her. Her life, her child, all of this, right? Like, but we also lost great art and great culture and the ability to make the world a happier and more beautiful place. And I think I was able to see that in Valley of the Dolls, in part because I'd seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And Tarantino has given us a vision of her and what she might have been and could have been, because Tarantino was really great at seeing the greatness in actors, even in actors who are not always, you know, considered great. Great performers. And I think he saw that in Sharon Tate, and I think he was right.
Okay, fair enough. That is it for Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Rebeller. Please, before you go, I would like to read a review off of our Apple podcast page. My favorite review this week is entitled Best Movie Podcast on the Internet. That's right, the whole internet. By Derek W. Thank you, Derek W. He says it is a first-rate podcast all the way, and who are we to argue with Mr. W? Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. And if you loved what we're doing here, please tell your friends and review us at Apple like Derek did. We need those reviews, people, and if you don't give them, we die. We all die. That's the sad thing about this. So you don't want us to die, do you?
We are all going to overdose on dolls and become catatonic and sink into the ocean. And that would be the worst possible fate for Sonny, to go out like the characters in Valley of the Dolls.
The worst.
Dreaming
of
the post-apocalyptic Spider-Man movie that he could have starred in.
Sad, sad times. All right. If you didn't love the show, please just complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. I will convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sonny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sonny Bunch and Natasha Pasetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sonier. Associate producer, Jessica Safavamare. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sonny Bunch, with music by James Malone.